That being said, it was one of the greatest basketball environments. Man, there was nothing better than to catch these Lakers coming in from an 80-degree day out in Los Angeles, you know, with their fur coats on in Milwaukee, and it's about 10 below here. And my boy Norm Nixon, Magic Johnson, guys, I'm friends with it. Man, how are you able to deal with this back here, man? I said, hey, man, it's Milwaukee. But they couldn't wait to get out of here, and they would normally get out of here with a butt kicking because between the crowd at the Mecca, the environment, everything going on in the city at that time, it was just a great, great place for us to be successful because of all the other elements outside of what's going on with the floor of basketball.
Hey everyone, welcome to this edition of the Go-Getters Podcast. It is your usual host, Richie Burke, but today we're going to be doing something a little different. We've got a couple big guns on the show. So if you don't know and you just stumbled upon this podcast, it's produced by my company, Go-Getter Marketing and Media, ggmm.io, as well as our friends over at On Milwaukee. And I've hosted every episode, but today we're going to have a guest host, Jeff Sherman, the owner of On Milwaukee and all around great guy, step in. This audio is actually from his Milwaukee Talks series through On Milwaukee, where he sat down and interviewed five-time NBA All-Star Marcus Johnson right before he got inducted into the Wisconsin Sports Hall of Fame. I think it was the day before. And it was just a great interview. They talked about his thoughts on going into the Hall of Fame. They compared his Bucks teams to the current Bucks team, talked about his family life, Giannis, the evolution of the game, his acting career when he was in White Men Can't Jump. It was a really good interview, so gave Jeff a call, asked if we could pull that audio, turn it into podcast form, put it on the Go-Getters Podcast. He said yes, so that is what you're going to be listening to today. And if you like this episode or want Jeff to host more, make sure to tweet him out. It's at Sherman Jeff. I'm guessing his name wasn't available, so he went with that one. So at Sherman Jeff, you can reach him there. And just a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by ggmm.io and On Milwaukee. And we will get right into it. Enjoy the show. And if you like it, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. That helps us out. So thanks again for tuning in.
Hey there, it's Jeff Sherman with On Milwaukee, sitting here in beautiful downtown Milwaukee, a little snow coming down outside the window. You can see all three arenas from our window here at On Milwaukee. You can see the Mecca, you can see the Bradley Center coming down, and you see the Five Serve. So it's fitting that we're sitting here with five-time NBA All-Star Marcus Johnson. A really cool moment for Marcus right now in his Milwaukee career, right? Going into the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame tomorrow night, and also very soon will be the first Bucks player to have his jersey retired in the new Fiserv Forum. Obviously, there's already 9 players with their jerseys retired, so Marcus adds himself to an illustrious group there. So we're going to talk a little bit with Marcus about his life, basketball, fun, and just have some fun as a fan myself. But Marcus, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, man. Pleasure being here. It's an exciting week. A lot of stuff happening.
Isn't it? Yes.
It's been good.
Good. Well, tomorrow night, you're going to go into the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame. I've spent a lot of time working on that project, been involved for many years. You look at the people that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, it's Oscar, it's Kareem, it's Paul Molitor, it's Robin Yount, a lot of wonderful people who have had storied careers. What's it mean to you to go into the Wisconsin Sports Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, it means a lot. You know, I was talking with my former teammate, Sidney Moncrief, a few weeks back. And one of the things he talked about was that the Wisconsin Hall of Fame being inducted into that meant for him as much as it would for him to be inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame. Now, I'm not sure if I'd go to that extreme, but his point was well taken. These are people who watched his career from the time he started as a rookie until the time he got done here in Milwaukee. So that's what makes it special. These are people that are really familiar with my body of work as a basketball player. And to have them honor and recognize me as such amongst all the other luminaries that have been inducted over the years. And I mean, Wisconsin has a really storied and rich sports tradition. It starts with the Packers and then the Brewer teams, as you mentioned. The Bucks and what they were able to do early on with Kareem and Oscar, and then what we were able to continue back in the late 70s, early 80s. So, you know, it's a lot of great tradition here in terms of sports and athletes and innovators, and to be selected to go into the Wisconsin Hall of Fame, it's just a great honor. I'm really happy about the honor.
Great. Yeah, it's gonna be a great night. And then on March 24th, the team is going to retire number 8, mm-hmm. put it up in the rafters. And March 24th, you know, selfishly for me, that's my daughter's birthday. My mom's birthday, well, no, my dad's birthday is the day before that. But I hear your mom's birthday is the 25th.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why when Peter Fagan mentioned a couple of months ago that they were going to retire my jersey, we had to kind of figure out what was the best date. And he wanted to do it after the All-Star break, which is in February. And so I thought about it. I checked the schedule out, and I saw we had a game against the Cleveland Cavaliers on the 24th, on a Sunday. My mom's birthday is on the 25th.
Okay.
She'll be 92 years old. She just started traveling by aircraft probably 4 or 5 months ago for a funeral of a relative we attended together in Seattle. And once she got through with that trip, she was like, she hadn't flown in like 25 years before then.
Okay.
So she was done with flying. All right. But she took that trip and said, okay, yeah, it's not that bad. I like flying. You know, you get there in 2 hours, it's all good. So she's like, I'm back in the saddle. I'm ready to fly again. So I figure with her birthday on that Monday, my jersey going up at Fiserv on Sunday, family, friends, old teammates coming in, it'll just be a great reunion and celebration of not only myself, but my mom and the role she's played in my life, both my mom and dad, the great support that they've shown me all throughout the years.
Yeah, no, that'll be a wonderful evening for fans, and obviously very special for you and your family, and that's what it's all about. It's all about family and basketball, right?
The eternal things of life. All that other stuff is fleeting. Trust me, and it fleeted. It did some fleeting. Yes, it did.
I want to talk a little bit about your Bucks team when you were here in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. and do a little compare and contrast to today's team. I know it's hard to compare eras, but if we go through starter by starter and just get your flavor and what you do on Fox Sports, and you see the team every day at practice and all the games, just let's compare the starters on your team with the starters on this team. Let's take Quinn Buckner and Malcolm Brogdon. You know, how are they different? How are they similar? And what would you say about both those guys?
Well, I mean, similarities would be both strong guards. Quinn was 6'3"-ish, about 215, 220 pounds, but just strong. He was a football player in high school, played both sports at Indiana University, I think his freshman year, before he gave up football and just concentrated on basketball. But he was a great leader, and I think that was the one quality that both he and Malcolm Brogdon, we call him the president, but he's just got this leadership quality Malcolm Brogdon does that it just exceeds his years. Now, he came in the league as an older rookie, I think at 23 years old because of injury and redshirted Virginia, but still, as a young man, he just got a tremendous future, in my mind, outside of basketball. And that's how we all felt about Quinn. Quinn was an NBA coach. He's into broadcasting now with the Pacers, been successful in business. And so I see Brogdon and Quinn, the similarities, the strength, the leadership, and some of the intangibles that they bring to the court. Now, Malcolm's a better shooter than Quinn was, even though Quinn had a 47-point game. Quinn was known as a non-scorer, but Quinn had a 47-point game against the San Diego Clippers back in the early 80s. So I guess even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Very good. Sidney Moncrief, Eric Bledsoe.
Yeah.
Looking at him different physical.
Right. Plot. Yeah. I mean, that's now. That they're totally different.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just polar opposites because Bledsoe is this 6'1", strong, overpowering kind of at point of attack defender, and that's his strength. But the similarities would be defense. When I think about their similarities, on-ball defense, Sidney Moncrief was one of the greatest two-way players in the history of this league, a guy that could give you 21 points a game but also was defensive player of the year in the same year. And you think about Michael Jordan in the year that he had when he averaged in his 30s and was defensive player of the year. We look at that as that special year. But Sidney was maybe a peg or two lower in terms of overall skill ability compared to Michael Jordan. But he was one of the all-time greats at both ends of the floor. Eric Bledsoe, he's showing some of the same attributes. Defensive point of attack, we count on him to stop the other guard and make things difficult and to fight through screens and to just play a physical style of basketball. And he's going to get scored on a lot. Kemba Walker gave him 40-plus. Harden gave him 40-plus for those games we won. And we knew that going in that they were going to get their points based on the style we were playing. Sidney didn't get burned quite to that degree, but it was a different era with a different philosophy. But both tremendous players.
Yeah. About two awesome shooters, Chris Middleton, Brian Winters. I mean, Brian Winters, for those that don't know, Marcus, talk a little bit about his shot. And just the amazing caliber of a shooter that Brian Winters was. Michael Jordan once called him one of the greatest shooters of all time.
Yeah, no, Brian was again, he should go down along with Jerry West and some of these great, great shooters that we think about in the past. And he was a very, you know, Brian coached a number of years in the league, and he was a guy that taught me footwork in terms of getting my shot off coming off of screens. Now, I didn't have the same effectiveness as he did because he was a much better shooter than I did, but he showed me a lot in terms of how to create separation and little things that helped me become a better player. And that's how I remember Brian Winters. But a devastating jump shooter, catch and shoot guy, a tremendous in the clutch. He was a guy. See, I never had the confidence that he and Junior Bridgman had in their jump shots. So I never hit a lot of game winners, but I was always a guy that penetrated, drew their defender, and then kicked it to them. So I always made the pass that led to the winning shot.
You got your 20 and 25.
Well, I got my 20 and 25, yeah, but I know my role. I knew my last thing, my lane. I knew I wasn't the guy that was going to knock down that open, you know, 20-footer with somebody flying at you, and Brian could do that. And Brian was funny. He wore this he had this Charles Manson looking kind of beard and long hair and crazy eyes during the season. But every year, the first day that the season ended, we'd have a team meeting. He'd go in the bathroom and shave the beard completely off. That was kind of his ritual. Now, Chris Middleton, let's talk about Chris. It's funny with Chris, you look at his numbers last year, 20 points a game, yada, yada, yay. But Chris averaged 37 minutes a game almost last year. This year, he's averaging 31 minutes a game. We've got a stat that's called per 36 minutes, what a guy scores, rebounds, gets assists per 36. They projected out over 36 minutes. His numbers per 36 this year at 17 points a game are better than last year. He's only playing 31 minutes. His assist numbers are up. His rebound numbers are up. They're at career high levels. Chris Middleton deserves to be an all-star. Now he's a guy, too, that is a great clutch shooter. We've seen him kind of make big shots in the Boston series against the Celtics last year, the game winner, the game tire. We eventually lost in overtime, but set that game in overtime. I watched him hit big shot after big shot in momentum sustaining situations. So their ability to knock down outside shots under pressure would be the driving similarity between the two.
I need on my Fox Sports app, I just need a Marcus button that I could press during the day, during the games, and you just, you know, analysis.
There's no off button.
That's right. I'm like, turn this guy off.
Where's the off button?
How about the center position? Yeah. Bob Lanier versus Brooke Lopez.
Well, you know, Bob Lanier's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
So we got to start with that.
Yeah.
Sidney Moncrief, in my mind, is a Hall of Famer. And Brooke Lopez is an outstanding player. And Brooke Lopez has been a really, really good addition to this team, better than I even thought. And I've known Brooke since he was 3 years old. He and his twin brother, Rob, and their older brother, Alex, played against my son, Chris, in high school. So they were 3 years old running around Montclair Prep High School out in the San Fernando Valley in L.A. They were 3 years old and about 5 feet tall. I mean, the biggest three-year-olds that you've ever seen in your life. But so I followed their careers. I did Brooke's game at Stanford when he had a triple-double against USC his sophomore year. He had 18 points, 12 rebounds, and 11 block shots. So I knew that the defense was there. Now, Robin, the twin, was always supposed to be the defensive brother. Brooke was the offensive brother. But Brooke did a smart thing. He's going to elongate his career. He started shooting three-point shots about 3 years ago with the Brooklyn Nets and then came out with the Lakers, started continuing to shoot three-point shots, and now we're seeing it's you know, it's Splash Mountain. It's just Brooke Lopez. It's just one of the best three-point shooters in the league, big or small. Should be in the three-point contest in the All-Star game. But Bob Lanier, the Daba, the Almighty Wonder, as he used to refer to himself. It's funny. He called himself the Almighty Wonder. He had these two young daughters. And I think one of them, Tiffany, snuck into the locker room, and she wrote on the chalkboard, the Almighty Wonder. you know, she wasn't doing it to get under his skin or anything. She just mistakenly kind of referred to him as the Almighty Wonder. That's what we started calling him that from that point on. But the issue with Bob with the Bucks is that I think we would have gotten him 2 years earlier. We picked him up when he was about 32 years old. Yeah. The knees were bad, but he was still giving us 17 points and 10 rebounds a game. And he was again one of the most devastating mid-range and long-range jump shooters for a big man. So that would be the similarity, the ability of both Brooke Lopez, Bob Lanier to go out on the perimeter and stroke that shot. Now Brooke's a righty, Bob was a lefty, but Bob had better range than he was ever able to show. If the three-point shot was as much of the game then as it is now, he'd be a big man who could shoot 42, 43, 41%. I'm talking about an outstanding shooting percentage from three-point range because he had that kind of soft touch. And a great athlete. We played tennis all the time together. His bad knees and all, and I'm just supposed to be this great in-shape guy, younger by 5 or 6 years than Bob. He would kick my butt on it. I could never beat him in tennis. Tennis, golf, he'd beat me in everything. He's just this great competitive spirit and one of the nicest guys you could ever want to be around.
That's great. You talked a little bit about your son, Chris. So you and your son, Chris, are the only father-son duo to win an NCAA championship. Right. At UCLA.
At the same school.
Right.
There's a few guys that have won.
That's awesome.
A few guys won championships for the Bibbies. Henry Bibby, his son Mike.
Right.
But Henry's at UCLA. Mike's at Arizona. Scott May and Sean May. I think Sean won it at North Carolina. Scott was at Indiana. There's a couple other guys, I think, father and son tandems that have done it. But we're the only two that did it at the same school. So that's, you know, whenever you do something that you're the first at doing it, it's a nice little feather in your cap.
Yeah, that's amazing. So there's one other position I can go through.
Okay.
Marcus Johnson.
Oh, I forgot about him.
And Giannis.
I thought there was one other guy.
Just talk about Giannis got here, your thoughts of drafting him, and the progress he's made.
Yeah.
And you can do the compare and contrast, too, with those two positions for sure.
I mean, I was fortunate to get here 3 years ago. Yeah. Giannis was just 20, 21 years old. He was coming off a season where he may have averaged 14, 15 points a game. So he was just starting to grow and develop into the dominant player that he is today. And I've watched how hard he's worked. My funniest story with Giannis was during that time, it was New Year's Day. We were in Minnesota somewhere practicing for a game the next day or that night. And so it's New Year's Day. So Giannis was like, he called me old school. Hey, old school. I watched some film of you playing. Man, you got buckets. My New Year's resolution. I'm going to get buckets like you get buckets. I was like, okay, young fella. So then I reminded Giannis of that this year's New Year's Day. I said, remember that 3 years ago? He said, yeah, I remember that. I said, so what's your New Year's resolution right now, 3 years later? And he said, to be the best version of myself. Hmm. And I said to him, I'm like, wow. Yeah, you know, when I was years of age, I was trying to think of how far I could get, how soon I could get to the disco, or, you know, where they, you know, I wasn't thinking about being the best version of myself. But that gives you an idea of kind of his maturity beyond his years. You know, he was selling trinkets on the streets of Athens. We know the story. At 15, 16 years old, to help support his family. He lived a hard, challenging type of an existence in Greece. To come over here to be who he is today in terms of his leadership qualities, in terms of the money that he's making to support his family and do good things for people close to him, he's a guy that shows a lot of appreciation for that. And so now, unlike myself, no, just, but I think that one of the similarities that I can point to, and that's not one of them, but one of the similarities I can point to is that we both worked extremely hard. And if you ask anybody who worked out with me, Junior Bridgman, Quinn Buckner, all those guys back in those days, they would tell you that you know, I had some of the hardest workouts during the off season that anybody had. I was one of the first guys in the league, maybe the first to hire my own skill development coach that I had since my days at UCLA that worked on different components of my game every year to help me become better. And so, yeah, but Giannis, you know, he's like a supersized version, if there's any comparison, because I was, you know, I'm 6'6", he's like 7 feet, and he's doing even more things than I can do in terms of being a point forward and leading the offense and rebounding and assist, and he's just a special, special person to be around. We were in Orlando recently playing a game, and I was on the court with Craig Kishun doing the post-game show, and all of a sudden, look behind me, here comes Giannis, Thon Maker, and the shooting coach, Ben Sullivan, and they're getting up shots after the game. Yeah, this is like a half an hour after, 20 minutes after the game had ended, they're back out on the court to get another 30, 40-minute workout. I was kidding with somebody recently that, you know, 30, 40 minutes after the game, when I played, we would been on our third beer in the sauna, rehydrating.
It's Orlando, come on.
Rehydrating on our third beer in the sauna here at the old Mecca, me and Ernie Grunfeld, rehydrating, you know, sitting in the sauna drinking beer. But Giannis is out there, but that just gives you an idea of his work ethic, and he's just a pleasure to be around and get to know. I give him his space. I don't try and give him advice about stuff or get in his face about too many things, because he's just a remarkable young man. But he's just, for me, it's been a pleasure to be associated with a talent like that.
Great. That's awesome insight. Appreciate it. I want to go back a little bit to, talked about Brooke Lopez developing the three-point shot. Definitely something more players are spending time with. What's that process like? Are three-point shooters born and not made? Can you, like,
well,
how do you incorporate that into your game now, knowing that it's so incredibly important in the modern game?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's just a question, again, it's where you put your focus, you know, it's where, and so like when I played, we didn't put our focus on shooting. I talk about Junior Bridgman, a great, great shooter, one of the most devastating jump shooters that I've ever been around or seen since I've watched basketball. And I looked at his numbers recently, and he shot like 22% from the three-point line because he didn't shoot a lot. He may have shot 20, 30 three-pointers during the course of a season. Those were at the end of shot clocks, at the end of quarters, at the end of halves, heaves, whatever. And so because of that, the percentage doesn't reflect the quality of shooter that he was. I always say, again, that if you know, we would have worked on that shot, if it would have been as important component of the game as it was, as it is now, then we would have been better shooters from that range. And so how you work on it, I mean, it's repetition. Anything that you do to become a better basketball player, it's all about repetition. And you look at a guy like Giannis, he's put in the repetition, he's put in the work. Now he's just got to get through the mental block of trying to show that he's a three-point shooter and prove that he can knock that down and shot on a consistent basis. The form is there, the rotation, all the stuff that you look for in a guy that's trying to become a good shooter is there. Now the toughest part is the mental hurdle to get through, especially when you haven't had a lot of success on a consistent basis with that shot.
Hey everyone, it's Richie Burke, your host of the Go-Getters and founder of GGMM. Since you're listening to this episode, you clearly understand the power of podcasting, yet a lot of brands have yet to take advantage of this medium. Based off the success of our podcast, we recently launched GGMM's podcasting content service, where we're currently helping brands like On Milwaukee, Trek Bicycle, Collier's, and more not only create audio and podcasting content, but also take that content and turn it into engaging video and written content to use across platforms. So if you're looking to better communicate with your employees internally or your consumers and are interested in learning more and think you're a good fit, just head to ggmm.io, ggmm.io. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Very good. Don Nelson, Budenhauser, yeah. Like Coach Bud's only been here a year, but talk a little bit about the coaching styles and the coaching evolution of the NBA since you're playing.
Well, the similarities between Coach Budenhauser and Don Nelson is the fact that they come from tremendous coaching pedigrees and basketball pedigrees. Don Nelson with the Celtics and Red Auerbach, and Bill Russell, and John Havlicek, and you know, I just throw those names.
A lot
out.
Of knowledge.
Well,
there.
I get chills thinking about just you know that level of a basketball knowledge just to be associated with. That's how he came into Milwaukee. Don Nelson wanted to be a referee initially. He was the first kind of ex player that was trying to venture into being a referee. I think he saw just how much abuse they took and and decided to go into coaching. And so my first year here was his first full year of coaching the Bucks. He had taken over for Larry Costello mid-season the year before, but it was the first year that he was the head coach. Mike Budenhauser was with the Greg Popovich coaching staff down in San Antonio for 18 years. Yeah. And so just you know, hanging around Greg Popovich, that staff, that knowledge for 18 years, you got to pick up something. And he's a very bright, bright coach. The similarities of approach is that they both kind of break the game down for you from the ground up. I call it the empty vessel approach, where they just approach you as an empty vessel in terms of your lack of NBA knowledge. And so with Don Nelson, it was, you know, how do you come off screens? What's your footwork like? How do you prepare for a jump shot defensively? What's your positioning? What's your hand positioning? Well, you know, just how do you slide defensively, effectively? So everything was done with the idea that you didn't know jack about the NBA game. And Mike Budenhauser doesn't go to those extremes, but it's the same type of teaching principle. Breaking it down, and the greatest example is DJ Wilson. I've been watching DJ work with his coaching staff for about 2 or 3 months in practice, after practice, just on help and recover. Help the penetration, get back to his guy. Help on penetration, get back on his guy. Now you see all that work, all that time spent drilling on that help and recover drill. He's one of the best help and recover defenders now for a big guy 6'10 that we have in the league right now. And that's why he can play and be effective, because his help and recover ability has been just outstanding. But it didn't happen. He just didn't fall out of bed one day being a great help and recover guy. Right. It was that hard work. And that's what the coach, Budenhauser and his staff, they do something called daily vitamins. And what that is you know, you got to take your vitamins every day. That's 20 minutes of work on the court or in film session or in a coach's office just talking about what's going on in your life. But every day, They guys have to do something in terms of their daily vitamins. Yeah. So that constant reinforcement from the coaching staff has made these guys get better. Final story on Budenholzer. Yeah. Every man from 1 to 12, 1 to 15, whatever, G League guys, Jalen Morris, who's a two-way player, we're playing Cleveland, and he's like the 14th man on the roster, and he's in the game early for some reason, injuries, and somebody's not playing. And so there's a timeout. I'm at the broadcast table with Jim, and they're right in front of us, and Coach Budenholzer calls Jalen Morris over to him, and Jalen Morris comes over and just puts his arm around Budenholzer's shoulder, and Budenholzer's drawing up something. He's got his arm around his shoulder like they're old friends, like they just know. But that's the kind of relationship that Coach Budenholzer has created, not only with Giannis and Chris and Bledsoe and Malcolm, the stars of the team, but also with those guys, Christian Wood and Jalen Morris, those guys at the end of the roster. You spend as much time with those guys because it's a team collective effort that's going to make this organization stay successful.
Yeah, that seems to be a constant in the Bucks organization, the consistent daily habits, the culture, and the relationships. Yeah. I mean, that makes an organization successful.
Right, and the innovative thinking. You go to the practice court, and they've got the quadrants of three-point areas on the floor where they want guys to field every time down transition or not. And so they've got these squares behind the three-point line about 5 feet. So when you catch it, you can step into your shot right at the three-point line. And the guys have been so conditioned for the past 4 or 5 months of practice of filling those quadrants. So right now it's second nature. And so if I'm Giannis and I drive to the basket and I get stuck in the air, I can throw it to a quadrant because I know that somebody's going to be there. I don't have to see them. I don't have to have eyes in the back of my head. I can just, so you see guys, Bledsoe throw a blind pass to an area, but he knows Brook Lopez or Chris or whomever, Tony Snell is going to fill that quadrant corner, break line, corner, break line, both sides of the floor. So but that's just the innovations of this coaching staff that have helped this team be successful.
Right. The final comparison question is the arena. You know, the innovations, the technology, and the newness of Fiserv compared to where you guys play.
Well,
and what that means to a community, what it means to a team, and, you know.
Right. Well, look, so here's a comparison with Fiserv and the Mecca. The Mecca, my first year, our seating capacity was like 10,980, let's say. And that's just kind of ballpark.
They grew it to like 11,052.
So
right?
We had a big expansion.
Yeah. It was huge.
I got the word, we're going to expand the Mecca. We're going to expand the Mecca. I was like, oh, great, man, we're going to expand the Mecca. I come back that next year. I said, yeah, the Mecca's expanded. What's our seating capacity? Well, instead of 10,980, it's 11,022. You know, and so about 40 seats they moved in different places in the arena. But that being said, it was one of the greatest basketball environments. Man, there was nothing better than to catch these Lakers coming in from an 80-degree day out in Los Angeles, you know, with their fur coats on in Milwaukee, and it's about 10 below here. And my boy Norm Nixon, Magic Johnson, guys, I'm friends with it. Man, how can you, man, how you able to deal with this back here, man? Like, hey, man, it's Milwaukee. But they couldn't wait to get out of here, and they would normally get out of here with a butt kicking because just between the crowd at the Mecca, the environment, everything going on in the city at that time, it was just a great, great place for us to be successful because of all the other elements outside of what's going on the floor with basketball.
Yeah, for sure. How much longer do I have to wait for Blue Chips 2?
Well, I think you'd have a much better chance of White Man Can't Jump Part 2.
Okay.
Blue Chips 2. The Blue Chips was a great experience. I mean, Ron Shelton was a guy that wrote both movies.
Okay.
And, I had a great time. Being around Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway and Nick Nolte.
Right, yeah.
Nick Nolte, I learned a lot in terms of being an actor in preparation. And you go into his trailer. I was one of his assistant coaches, so we spent a lot of time together. But he's got all kinds of notes, voluminous notes, just taped all over his trailer from watching practice at Indiana, talking with Bobby Knight and other coaches around the league. Pete Newell, one of the greatest coaches of all times, was Dr. Bombay, but he was kind of the basketball advisor on that film and did a great job just teaching Nick about coaching and what to do, what to be, how to think as a coach. So we had a ball. We had a great time, a lot of fun. White Man Can't Jump was another movie that was great. Wesley Snipes, Woody Harrelson. The funny story with that is that the first time that I met them, we had a training camp, 10 to noon, every day, 5 days a week, in South Central Los Angeles at Rancho Cienega Park. And so Wesley Snipes couldn't do a three-man weave, something real basic. So if you messed up that drill, you had to do it again. So every time Wesley would get to the front of the line, the other two guys that were with him would do something to try and get out of going with Wesley Snipes in that drill. So it's either, I got to tie my shoe, or man, I need to tug my shorts up a little bit, put another shirt on. So finally, Wesley kind of caught on to what we were doing. So, oh, yeah, I see what y'all doing. Okay, you know, a few curse words. But, yeah, just give me about 2 weeks, and I'm going to show you. About 2 weeks later, he was doing a three-man weave just as well as anybody. So he was a great athlete, not a basketball player. Woody was a great gym rat basketball player. Woody Harrelson, first time we played together in a three-on-three kind of situation, kind of a pickup ball kind of a situation. He's out there playing, and he calls this bogus foul. I'm like, Woody, that's a BS foul, man. He's like, what do you mean? Are you trying to impugn my integrity? I said, first of all, I went to Crenshaw. I don't know what impugn means. Secondly, we're out here playing. Don't get all worked up. It's not that serious. So we started laughing, and from that point on, had a great relationship. But we had so much fun with the actors and the ball players, and hanging out at Venice Beach every day, and just a great, great experience.
Yeah. And obviously you learn a lot through making movies that's helped you as an announcer and an analyst today, right? What are some of those lessons and some of the, in the movies, you're reading scripts, you're learning from actors. Yeah. How does that work what you do today?
Well, the main thing with acting and, I've been in theater arts since 11, 12 years old, okay. In middle school, high school, UCLA. I was a theater arts major, did plays and all kinds of stuff and had my own TV show at UCLA on closed circuit TV. But the main thing with acting is this, and I've studied, for years and years with really great reputable teachers out in Los Angeles, is just to be in the moment and not to try and preordain what it is you want to feel, think, right. Say, emotions you want to show. Just experience it. Let it happen. And so that's something that has helped me as a broadcaster. I probably early on in my broadcasting career was so caught up into kind of doing it right and saying it right and what kind of clever reactions I was going to have. Now I just kind of let it happen organically, and that's the best way to do it. And just I think people can get the feeling watching and listening that it's a genuine, unrehearsed kind of organic reaction as opposed to something that just sounds canned and fake and phony. So
yeah. That's a great lesson. Yeah. Live in the moment. It makes you a better parent, a better person in everything you do. Right?
Exactly. Because you can't plan. You can't plan out the future. The future's like a second ahead and all that stuff. So the one thing that you learn in acting is that if you say a line the same way when you're rehearsing over and over again, then you're not doing it authentically because you have different impulses, different feelings, different thoughts. Every moment that you're alive, there's different thoughts going on in your mind, and then you just allow that to come through in terms of whatever it is, whatever character or scene you're trying to perform. So in broadcasting, it's the same way. And that's what I always tell our producers when we're going over the pregame format or whatever. I just say, look, every game has its own kind of storyline, no matter what it is. I don't care who the team, how bad they are. If it's the Knicks coming in, they've lost 10 in a row. Well, yeah, but they play well against the good teams, or they got some guys on their team that have a vendetta because they were traded by the Bucks. So there's always some nice little backstories going on that you can have some fun with and make the game a little bit more interesting for the viewer.
Yeah. What have you learned from Jim Paschke?
From Jim Paschke, I just learned about, with Jim, preparation. That's the one. And producing. I mean, he's been around this thing so long. He's our broadcast coordinator. So he's the head guy in terms of who the league kind of contacts if they want to get some information about camera setups. So he knows that production in as well as anybody. And so what I'll do, we have our production call, 10 o'clock every game day. We've got a production call in that city's time zone, 10 o'clock if it's Eastern. In New York, it's 10 o'clock. If it's L.A., it's 10 o'clock. But what I do, I'll just regurgitate a whole bunch of thoughts and what I'm thinking and how this game and how the team has been playing and where we're headed and where we've been. And then I'll say, okay, Jim, make something out of that. And Jim will say, okay, well, look, yeah, I like that. So what we should do, first segment, we'll do, we'll spend 2 or 3 minutes on this. And then maybe we segue into Katie. She can bring in Nicole, And so I just throw it out there and let him make sense of it because he is so good at kind of the production and organizing my thoughts that are all over the place. And I do that on purpose. I just want to get, and just want to look, I got all kinds of stuff going on and here it is. I give a lot of thought to this stuff. I'm a basketball junkie. I love the game. And so I'm always watching film and researching and reading stuff. And so I'll just bring that to the table and then let them make some form and content out of it.
Very good. All right. So I have the Sidney Moncrief poster hanging in my my office. You have the Johnson's Law, what goes up what goes right. in, poster of you skying over a kind of a quasi-fake Milwaukee skyline, but an iconic poster.
Yeah, sure. Like,
that was that poster, it was Sidney's poster, it was the George Gervin poster. Do you have one of those hanging anywhere in your house? Or?
No, I don't. No. I mean, but
they're hard to find online. I can't find one.
But the great story is, and I wish I could find or make a poster out of this shot. There's a shot that's posted on Twitter, and people have seen it, but it's Michael Jordan in his dorm room in North Carolina. He's kind of goofing around, being silly with an umbrella or something, and a CBS Sports banner in the back. But if you look closely on the wall behind him, there's a poster of me in that Johnson's Law, what goes up goes in. Now, here's a funny story with that. So we're shooting a movie, Space Jam, out in Los Angeles, Warner Brothers Studio. Michael Jordan needed some guys to come out and play against him just to keep him in shape. I think he was just about to make his comeback. And so they've built this basketball dome, this tented dome out on Warner Brothers lot. They've got every weight machine. They've got gambling tables, poker tables. They've got big speakers and music, and Queen Latifah's there, and all the and Angela Bassett and David Falk, his agent, and all these just high roll. Dean Cain, Superman, is playing 2-on-2, 3-on-3 with us on a daily basis. So one day we're playing 3-on-3 before the real run starts. So Michael's out there, we're playing 3-on-3. And so I go up for like a little dunk and dunk it kind of easily. And so Michael kind of gets on me. He's like, "Oh, come on, old man. You know, dunking was never part of your game, man. You know, don't be trying to dunk out here." I was like, "Michael, I don't know what I was doing, but you had my poster on your wall when you were in college. I must have been doing something right." He was like, Yeah, you got me on that.
Yeah.
I used to love your game back. Yeah, I used to love your game. Yeah, you got me on that. So that's kind of my claim to fame. And anytime you can have Michael Jordan, in my mind, one of the greatest, if not the greatest of all times, he's got your poster behind him on a wall in college. You know, it said something.
Yeah, so. That's good. That's good stuff. Space Jam 2? You going to get into that? It's happening, isn't it?
No,
it's
like, well, and here's my
Marcus in that.
And here's my Space Jam. I was in Space Jam 1. Did something in that, but there was another role that they wanted me to do, and it was playing the monsters, those big gigantic monsters. So they're doing that on the green screen, but you had to wear these real tight, these real skin tight. So I put on this skin tight green acrylic outfit, and I'm out of shape. My belly's kind of hanging out, and I look at myself in the mirror, and I go to the guy who's in charge of casting. A friend of mine named Nigel McGill, and I just looked at him and said, "Man, I can't go out there like this, man." He's like, "What do you mean?" I said, I can't do this. He said, "Okay, that's okay. We'll find something else for you to do." I was like, all right, thank you, I appreciate that. But it was a bigger role, you know, but you never see the faces of those characters because they were animated, but you had to go through all the movement and all that, so you had to put on the whole deal so they could hook you up. But man, I wasn't, if I was in the shape I'm in today, I could have done it. But back then I was a slob, so I had to get out there.
All right.
I got my pride.
All right. That's good. So last question I always like to ask most people I meet. You've had a lot of success in many different areas of your life, but define success for me.
When you say that, I go to my old coach, John Whitten, but basically, I mean, it's just the peace of mind of knowing that, you know, you've done the best that you could do to be the best that you could be. And so with that entails the Odyssey. I'm working on a one-man show, do some writing, and so I got a basketball Odyssey that I'm working on to present as a one-man show at some point. It may be sooner, it may be later. But what I'm kind of discovering is that through all the ups and especially the downs, that I've come to this point in my life where I am now because I've had to go through all that stuff. You know, I wish I didn't have to go through 90% of it, you know, even more sometimes, because it's a lot of substance abuse, a lot of stuff, a lot of alcoholism, the death of a child. I mean, a lot of stuff, a lot of dark days in those 80s. The 80s was tough. You know, a lot of dark days in those 80s. But I understand today that I did go through it. I walked through it. I came out a stronger, better person before it. And so now whatever happens in life, and to me, that's success. And so because I exude, I think, that kind of successful confidence of having walked through stuff, now people are more willing to hire you for different jobs and they kind of want to be around you and interview you and talk to you. Right. Because back before then, you know, it's hard to look people in the eye because I knew the lifestyle I'm living and what I'm doing. And I like to say that I've been blessed, I've been fortunate to live two lifestyles in one lifetime. A lot of people can't say that. A lot of people don't need to say that. That first lifestyle has been good enough for them. But for me, I've had to live these two lifestyles in one lifetime, and for that, I'm eternally grateful.
Very good. Well, congratulations again, and thanks for your time today, and Dr. Johnson's Law, right there.
Appreciate it.